It's almost Thanksgiving, and here at the Allegheny Front, that means we're thinking about food and the environment, even more than usual. We'll taste a plant-based burger made to fool meat lovers.
You're gonna see blood. You can see it starting to come out now as it cooks.
And we'll travel to the Great Lakes for the wild rice harvest.
You essentially don't see water when you're looking at this. You just see a field of grasses.
Plus, we're examining the diet of one of America's favorite birds this time of year. I'm Carol Holsapple. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Few things have as big an impact on our environment as the food we eat. Agriculture accounts for one-third of global greenhouse gas emissions, and beef production, in particular, uses copious amounts of water when compared with other foods. So some scientists have been working in the lab to create a vegan burger that bleeds like beef without these downsides. They're serving what they call the Impossible Burger at select restaurants around the country. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant found one in Pittsburgh.
This is one of the best work days. I'm meeting colleagues at Burgatory, a high-end burger place in Pittsburgh, to try the Impossible Burger.
Hi, I'm Kara Holsapple. I'm the host of the Allegheny Front.
Kara eats vegan. She makes homemade veggie burgers. But the Impossible Burger is supposed to really taste like meat.
And I'm excited. How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, I'm excited to have it.
That's Hal B. Klein. He's a restaurant critic and editor at Pittsburgh Magazine. This summer, he wrote an article called Burgers, Burgers, Burgers.
And I probably ate around 45 burgers researching the story.
Hello. My name is Jules. I'll be taking care of you guys.
Yeah. The Impossible Burger for me?
Impossible Burger for me.
Yeah, I want the Impossible Burger, but I want the vegan cheese and mayo.
And the mayo?
Yeah.
All right.
I followed Chef Brad Koha to the kitchen.
Careful, might be a little slick.
He pulls out a stack of regular-looking patties and peels one off. Meat burgers go on the open-fire grill. Impossible burgers sizzle on the flat top.
Just like a regular burger. You put it on, the patty looked kind of dry, but as we're cooking it now, you can see that heme, that blood, the fat coming out.
That heme, Chef Koha mentioned, the blood-like juice that seeps out as it cooks, it's the key reason why this vegan burger debuted not in the freezer aisle, but at New York's well-known Momofuku Nishi restaurant. It's also why the company behind it, Silicon Valley's Impossible Foods, has garnered a reported $300 million in investments from the likes of Bill Gates and Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz. So what is heme? The company did not respond to an interview request.
Introducing Impossible Burger.
This is a video from their website.
Invented by a pretty cool scientist named Pat Brown.
Brown left his position as a biochemistry professor at Stanford University to develop this plant-based burger with all the properties of meat. On the video, they mix up wheat and potato flour to give it texture. They crack a coconut. Its oil provides the fat. And there's a small bowl of a blood-like liquid.
What's this red stuff?
That is heme. It's the same molecule that carries oxygen in your blood and makes it red. But it's actually found in every living thing, even plants.
Impossible Foods uses genetic engineering to take a protein gene called leg hemoglobin from the root of a soy plant and add it to a yeast strain. They grow the yeast through fermentation, then isolate the heme and add it to their burgers.
Well, that turns out to be, one, their big claim to fame, and two, their big Achilles heel.
Carl Badd is a professor at Cornell's Department of Food Science. He says the Food and Drug Administration did not approve soy leg hemoglobin for consumption.
It turns out the FDA doesn't consider that to be generally recognized as safe.
But Impossible Foods doesn't actually need FDA approval and started selling the burger anyway. The company has said their burger is lab tested and safe to eat. And it's scaling up to produce 1 million pounds per month. Their video spells out why eating one Impossible Burger is better than a beef patty.
You save water equivalent to a 10-minute shower. You spare 18 driving miles worth of greenhouse gases. And you spare 75 square feet of land for wildlife and more.
But the question for high-tech food companies and for us at lunch at Burgatory, would people actually choose this vegetarian protein over cow meat?
All right. I have your Impossible Burgers here.
All right. I mean, it's interesting, right? So it's like a little bit mushier than a beef burger. And there's like a sort of grain flavor.
I don't see any blood. I mean, it is a little pink in the middle, but it's not like bloody. I thought I might be a little grossed out, but I'm not.
And we put the question to Chef Kohut.
The Impossible Burger would fool anyone?
Well, definitely fool people, but there's a lot of foolish people out there.
for the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
So biting into an Impossible Burger with its genetically modified ingredient made us curious about other GMOs on the market and some of the issues around them. Gene Hollerin is director of food policy initiatives at Consumers Union. That's the policy and lobbying arm of Consumer Reports magazine, the people who test everything, then tell you about it. Hollerin's been looking at GMOs with a critical eye, and I recently spoke with her by phone about them. How much of what's sold to consumers in the produce aisle or as fresh foods is actually GMO?
Well, that's actually a tougher question than you might think. The main crops that are genetically engineered in the United States are corn, soy, canola, and sugar beets. Most of the corn and soy actually goes as animal feed. In terms of the produce aisle, we're a little unsure because we don't have mandatory labeling. There have been some kinds of produce that have gone through an FDA safety review. Some sweet corn, there's some zucchini, potatoes, and just now they're introducing a variety of apple, the Arctic apple, whose main characteristic is that it doesn't go brown when you cut it open.
And from my understanding, the genetic modification is that it silences the gene that makes apples turn brown. Is that different? I think we've heard a lot more about adding genetic code from other organisms to genetically modify them. Is it different than that?
Yes and no. The vast bulk of the products that have been modified so far have been modified with added genes to tolerate glyphosate, which is better known as Roundup, an herbicide, so that they can spray the field with herbicides and the crop doesn't die, but the weeds do. Now, these new techniques for the potato and the Arctic apple are what they call a gene silencing technique, and they call it sometimes gene editing, where you may not necessarily introduce genetic material from some other plant or bacteria or, you know, insect or something. But in fact, in terms of what we view as the risks of genetic engineering and the reason why it should go through a safety assessment are the same. Because once you start tinkering with the genetic code, things can happen not just at the part of the code that you want to change, but elsewhere in the genome. And genomes are so complex. You know, it's like a very, very complex computer program.
So when a GMO is proposed by a company, how do we know it's safe to eat? What's the oversight?
Well, that's one of our biggest concerns, because in the U.S. at this point, we only have a system for voluntary safety consultations. But the companies will say that everything on the market has actually gone through a voluntary consultation. There's one exception to that, though, which is something now on the market. I don't know if you've seen them talking about the Impossible Burger.
I've eaten one.
You've eaten one?
Yes.
Well,
okay, tell me about it now.
It contains genetically engineered blood, which has not gone through an FDA safety review. So to try to make it more like a meat burger, these folks genetically engineered, I believe it was a yeast, to produce the equivalent of hemoglobin, the red stuff that makes blood red. Now, originally, they actually went to FDA and said, will you please, you know, evaluate this? And FDA wrote back and said, the data that you have provided so far is not sufficient to make a safety assessment. Please provide us with actual safety testing. Because they, in their original assessment, just kind of argued from theory. So they withdrew their application for a review and then just started marketing the burger. And this is perfectly legal.
There was a big GMO labeling debate last year in Vermont. Where do things lie now? How do consumers know if the foods that they're eating have GMO ingredients or have been genetically modified in some way?
You can't know, unfortunately. Vermont passed a labeling law that was supposed to go into effect a year ago. But the biotech and food marketing lobbies were extremely opposed to this, and they went to Congress and got Congress to pass a law that preempted all states from ever requiring labeling of genetically engineered food. What they did require, they said, well, we will have a federal system of disclosure. You could actually label the product if you wanted to, but you can also use this thing called a QR code.
And you can use your smartphone to scan that, right?
And you can use your smartphone to scan it. We thought that was not an acceptable solution because among older people and among low-income people and among rural people, smartphones are, in some cases, not even owned by a majority.
Jean Holleran is director of food policy initiatives at Consumers Union. There's more, including links to some of our previous reporting on GMOs, like when Julie Grant and I cooked almost an entire Thanksgiving meal.
Careful, it's going to be hot. Well, this is going to be a corn soup to start off the meal. This is a big player in the GMO world.
Can you pass the bread, please? That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke wants to shrink some of the West's national monuments. He favors oil and gas development over preservation of these wide-open spaces. But he's an outdoorsman, and he sees a direct line between himself and a towering figure in conservation.
Up front, I'm a Teddy Roosevelt guy.
Teddy Roosevelt had the courage 100 years ago. The reorganization is going to be bold and look at just as Teddy Roosevelt did.
But is Ryan Zinke a Roosevelt guy? We'll explore that question next week on a special Allegheny Front. If we're talking Thanksgiving foods, we're talking turkey. Hobby farmer and Allegheny Front commentator Ken Chiacchia has a take on his gang. That's a group of domesticated turkeys. He says not all turkeys are created equal, that there's a difference between a locally sourced turkey and one from a large commercial operation. His proof? One particularly big bird.
I sing you the song of Turkmenistan, a 43-pound monster of a tom turkey we raised on our little farm. Stan actually wasn't the only scale buster we've raised. For a number of years, the processor we take them to has commented on how large our birds are. Our secret isn't actually a secret. We pasture them. Now, many of you will know what that means, but the government and large producers have conspired, intentionally or not, to make the terminology confusing. So let me get to that first. The byword in alternative food sourcing used to be free range. When you use that term, many people pictured what we do with our birds. In the morning, I feed them some grain and open a pop door so that they can go outside and roam our 26 acres. In the evening, my wife Heather closes the door behind them. Come sundown, they've filed back into the coop on their own, ready for bedtime. The USDA, though, gives an amazingly short definition of free range. Quote, producers must demonstrate to the agency that the poultry has been allowed access to the outside. That's it. It doesn't specify how long or what surface the bird has access to. A few minutes on gravel will satisfy the requirement. So we small-scale farmers fell back on pastured to convey that the birds actually have meaningful access to grass, bugs, and a generally natural environment. Chickens and turkeys are both omnivores and enthusiastically hunt and forage all day when given the opportunity. In our case, in addition to mowed grass, our birds forage in the pastures where we keep our goats and sheep, as well as scrub brush and even some woods. Adolescent turkeys are like little predatory dinosaurs, and they're prodigious foragers. Heather noted early on that when we gave them the ability to hunt out their own food, we didn't need to feed them as much grain. They actually prefer the wild stuff. People have this idea that turkeys are stupid, but they're only non-precocial. They aren't born with as many innate behaviors as chickens. Given a more natural environment, they're inquisitive and enterprising. In any case, pasturing has been good to our turkeys, and we believe it's good for us too. You see all sorts of claims about the health benefits and taste improvements from pastured and other locally sourced meats, but for us, it's as much about the animal's quality of life. Turkmenistan got so large because he got to live like a real turkey, and that meant having some freedom to feed himself. We couldn't even sell him because people wouldn't believe he'd fit in the oven. But he did, and he was delicious.
That was Allegheny Front commentator Ken Kiakia. There's another turkey living its best life in our region, the wild turkey. According to the Pennsylvania Game Commission, urban turkey populations are likely to grow. They live wherever food is plentiful, and that includes Frick Park in Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy recently led a family hike into the woods there to look for turkeys and practice calling for them.
Gobble, gobble.
The kids learned from naturalist educator Amber Stacy what wild turkeys like to eat and how.
Who remembers how a turkey finds its food?
Scratch at the ground.
They scratch at the ground. So they take their feet, take your feet, and they scratch at the ground, and they move the leaves to the side. And what kind of things might they be looking for? Do you remember?
Bugs.
They might be looking for bugs, acorns. Anything else they might look for?
Seeds.
5-year-old Emily Swartz foraged for foods turkeys would be excited about.
I found one of those snails.
And for some kids, like Reggie Cubis, it was enough to rethink this whole being a human business.
I wish I was a turkey because then I would get to scratch at the ground a lot. And I think it's really fun to like find food and it's just randomly there instead of going to buy it at a market.
So whether you're acquiring your Thanksgiving feast in a forest using your feet or at the market, happy Thanksgiving from all of us at the Allegheny Front. Sometimes what's on the holiday table isn't nearly as exciting as the conversation around it, especially when it comes to hot topics like climate change. If you're like me, the idea of talking about it with my family is a little nerve-wracking. So a couple of years ago, I spoke with Mary Beth Manorino about this. She's a professor emeritus at Chatham University and a clinical psychologist. I went to her office to learn how to navigate a family gathering where there might be lots of different views on environmental issues and climate change. If these issues come up, how can we talk about them? Well, a lot has changed in a couple of years. President Trump, who has said he doesn't even know if climate change is real, is dialing back the climate policies of Obama. At the same time, we're hearing dire warnings from climate scientists. So I asked Mary Beth Manorino to come to our studios this time and give me a refresher. Thank you for joining me again.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
So I'm going to play a clip from the last time that we talked a couple of years ago. And the question I asked was, how do we begin to have a conversation with someone about climate change or any touchy issue, a person that you know or maybe suspect has a different opinion or point of view about it than you do? And here's what you said.
If you reach out and ask the other person about their beliefs and what do they know about climate change, and show a genuine interest in it and why they feel so strongly about it, and then you're meeting them where they are, and then you can say something like, I've done a lot of thinking about this as well because it's potentially very upsetting. And here are some things that I've done to educate myself about it. So that's one of the things, is to meet them where they are.
So is that still your advice?
In part, I would stand by that. I think what I'm finding now is that people who are involved in fighting climate change, other environmental issues, or even other political concerns, is that there is a sense of urgency that has increased. And so that potentially brings more energy to the conversation, often on both sides, which can either make it go even better or can really cause it to blow up. So, yes, I stand by meeting them where they are, but I would also go a little deeper and take some risks in talking a little more deeply about it with them.
How would you do that?
I just recently participated in the climate reality leadership training. And one of the very simple questions that we can ask at those times is, if you meet someone who really doesn't buy into the reality of climate change. You can just simply ask, what about that concerns you the most? And many times you'll find out that there's just a misunderstanding of facts or even a level of avoidance of finding information. So taking the risk to not just kind of accept what the person is saying, but really asking them, what is it about this that concerns you, is something that might take the conversation further.
The climate reality leadership core training, that presentation was given in Pittsburgh recently. It's given all over the world, and it's led by, of course, former Vice President Al Gore, as sort of a way to train people really to not only talk about climate change, but to kind of convince people about climate change and take action.
Right. And one of the other things that I would say about this is that if you are passionate about this, find a way to communicate that passion in a positive way. There's a way to do that without denigrating people who don't buy in, but just by example, showing them that you have learned so much and you have so much still to learn, but you're really in it for the long haul because it matters so much to the future of our grandchildren and even our current lives. I think I would honor that passion that you carry about it if you are an activist and not just try to soften that. In psychology, one of the things we talk about a lot is speaking from the I position rather than you, so that you can still stay engaged in a conversation by saying, this is what I believe, and this is what I have found out, and what I know, and why I'm in this, without attacking the other person or assuming something about how they feel.
I think a lot of people would agree that topics like climate change are even more divided along political lines than they were a couple of years ago since the election of President Trump. Would you say that's true, and how would that impact your advice?
I think it's absolutely true. I think we hear about that every day in the news. We see the evidence of that. And so the urgency that I mentioned earlier, the climate getting worse and about the U.S.'s official position at the federal level to back out of the climate agreement.
The Paris Climate Agreement.
The Paris Climate Agreement is there, but there's also an opportunity that has urgency to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and to really take it on yourself to be one of the people who builds bridges rather than stays in your own silo and tries to maintain your position regardless of where the other person is. It's one of the biggest challenges I've ever seen, and the impact on this country through that divisiveness is profound.
So reach across the aisle and the Thanksgiving table.
And the Thanksgiving table. Reach across the turkey. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Mary Beth Manarino is a professor emeritus at Chatham University and a clinical psychologist. She has another tip for holiday gatherings. Avoid talking about climate change if you or others are drinking alcohol. It impairs our inhibitions, and someone might say something they can't take back. There's more of our conversation at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. We've been talking about holiday food, and my favorite stuffing recipe calls for a cup of wild rice. So here's a story from our partners at Great Lakes Today from Minnesota. For generations, Native Americans in the northern Great Lakes have harvested wild rice. It's an important food source, and for some, it's a way to make a little extra cash. It's also a cultural touchstone that tribal members are trying to pass on to younger generations. Dan Crocker checked out the recent wild rice harvest.
Thomas Howes is standing at the canoe landing of a small lake about a half hour outside Duluth. It's part of the reservation of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa.
Today I'm looking at what we call Jaganashin, so double winning, or dead fish lake in English.
The lake is almost completely covered with the tall green stalks of wild rice plants.
You essentially don't see water when you're looking at this. You just see what looks like a field of grasses.
Wild rice is the slender black grain of an aquatic reed-like plant that grows out of the muck in the bottom of shallow lakes and rivers. It grows mainly in Minnesota, but it's also found in parts of Wisconsin and Michigan. It has a rich, distinctive, nutty flavor when it's cooked. Howes, who's the band's natural resources manager, says to understand why wild rice is so important to the Chippewa or Ojibwe people, you have to know their history. They migrated to the Great Lakes region from the Northeast about 500 years ago. According to oral traditions, a prophecy told them to journey west until they came to a place where food grew on the water.
You know, we came here from the East Coast of the United States and were told that we'd find our permanent home where we found this wild rice or this manomin, this food. And that's held to be true.
But a lot of the rice disappeared from the Fond du Lac Reservation after the government dug drainage ditches in the early 1900s, part of a futile effort to make the land more suitable for farming. That disrupted the hydrology of the wild rice lakes. For about 20 years now, the tribe has been working to restore those lakes and bring the rice back. As we talk, a pair of men pull up in a canoe, including 58-year-old Ed Jocola. He says he's been ricing as long as he can remember.
Yeah. Probably 45 years for me.
His partner Jared Ojibwe helped scoop about 80 pounds of green rice out of the canoe bottom into big plastic bags. There will be a lot less of it once it's dried and processed. The finished product sells for about $10 a pound. Ojibwe is happy to see the rice return to the reservation, but he worries about something else. He says the younger generation isn't carrying on the tradition of ricing.
The younger ones that are all on Facebook somewhere.
He says they're scared of the water, scared of bugs. Later, another canoe pulls up to the landing at Dead Fish Lake. 20-year-old Bruce Martineau heaves it onto shore. He started ricing 5 years ago with his grandfather. Now he's with his dad, Francis Martineau. I ask them why they do it.
It's my culture. Natives done it all. It's the beginning of time. This is, once we lose this, then we lose being as a people, I guess. Like, can't lose this or the language.
What brought us here, the food that grows on the water.
Yeah.
Bruce plans to print up some business cards and try to sell rice to restaurants. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources estimates wild rice is worth at least $2 million to the state's economy every year. But most people on the Fond du Lac Reservation eat what they harvest. Bruce Martineau says he also always gives some away.
God gives this, get your money, do gives this, so it's only right to give it back, you know? Give it to other people that can't go out there.
Francis Martineau says he's proud of his son for keeping the tradition of wild ricing alive. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Dan Crocker on the Fond du Lac Reservation in northern Minnesota.
Great Lakes Today is a collaborative led by WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. For more stories, go to greatlakestoday.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. And we have a podcast, Trump on Earth. All of the episodes are at trumponearth.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.